And indeed, stay tuned as well for my first guest this morning. She became a household name with her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. It sold over 15 million copies worldwide. And of course, you'll remember it was a huge movie at the time starring Julia Roberts. So Eat, Pray, Love was about the breakup of Elizabeth Gilbert's first marriage. And it told the story of her subsequent voyage of self-discovery. It took her to Italy, India and Indonesia, where she ate, prayed and loved. And on this trip, despite having sworn off marriage, she met her second husband. Now, since then, that marriage ended, and it ended when Gilbert realised that she was in love with her female best friend. So now she's back with a new novel. She describes it as a champagne cocktail. It's called City of Girls, and it's set in the 1940s theatre world. But she wrote this latest book while grieving for her partner, whom she had nursed through a battle with terminal cancer. I spoke to Liz last week when she joined me from New York, and she explained to me first how she managed to write such a light-hearted novel in these circumstances.
Yeah, I actually had been working on the book for 5 years, just doing the research for it. I hadn't actually started writing it, and then she became ill, and I put it away for 18 months. Anybody who's been a primary caregiver for, well, one, somebody who's dying of a terrible disease, and two, who's the love of your life, knows that there's not really room for anything else, you know? So I put that aside, and after her death, I was shocked to discover that I still wanted to write it, because the book that I had in my imagination was something that I wanted to go down like a champagne cocktail, you know, something very light and joyful about showgirls in New York City in the 1940s behaving badly and promiscuity and recklessness and a kind of wild sort of energy to the book, which is very much the opposite of what grief feels like. And to my surprise, I discovered that that was exactly what I needed to do in that moment. I think it was a kind of way of counterbalancing all the pain that I had been in. But as you noticed, the themes of grief and loss snuck in there. I don't think I would have written it quite the same way if Rhea had lived.
Yes, yes. It's, in a way, it's a book of two parts, isn't it? And there's a champagne cocktail at the beginning, but there's a bit of a bit more of a kick in the second half of the book then, in a way. So I suppose we should explain to people the background of you and Rhea, because it's a fascinating kind of story. If we go back first to, people will remember, Eat, Pray, Love was inspired by the collapse of your first marriage, and you headed off and you were never going to get married again, but you did get married again.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2-3 years ago, you ended that marriage.
Yeah, 2.5 years ago. So,
do you want to explain to us the circumstance of that? You and Rhea were best friends.
Yes, I was married to this wonderful, beautiful man for years, and but I also kept deepening my friendship with my best friend, who I had known. She and I had been friends for 17, at the time of her death, we'd known each other for 17 years. But in the years prior to her diagnosis, I would say in the 4 or 5 years prior to that, I had lost the ability to even find the right word to describe what she was in my life. The word best friend, it just didn't seem to do it. And so I had come to the point where I simply called her my person. I didn't know how else to describe it. It was, and I knew in my heart, but didn't know quite what to do with it, that she was the most important person in my life. She became, over time, the one person I could not live without. My first phone call in every crisis, my advisor, my comfort, my person. And I never acted on it in any way. I never intended to. But then she was given this terminal diagnosis, and it just became... And I'll tell you very frankly that I saw an image in my mind of her dying without ever knowing what she had been to me and without me ever having expressed it. And that just felt, my soul was appalled by the idea of that happening. And so I had to be very honest with her and with my husband and with myself about my feelings. And everything changed very rapidly after that. And I will also say that nobody was surprised. Nobody who knew us, nobody in that story was surprised. And I guess I was the last one to know.
Can I tell you a funny thing? I watched last night a video on YouTube of you doing a conversation with her at an Australian book festival.
Uh-huh.
Does that ring a bell?
Yes, yes, the Sydney Opera House.
This was before you obviously had expressed your feelings for it, yeah, and everything. Have you watched that back ever?
I can't bear to, but I know what you're getting at, which is quite simply, duh.
Yeah, get a room, you two. If that's not two people in love.
I know, and when we told people their reactions, the people who knew us, their reactions ranged from, you know, in other news, ice is cold, to, you know, people who had thought for years that, well, we always assumed that you two had some sort of sexual relationship that you were hiding or some arrangement within the marriage. Like, nobody was like, what? So I just think sometimes we ourselves are the last ones to notice what's actually happening with our very ungovernable hearts.
Tell me a bit about Raya. She was an extraordinary person, wasn't
she? Oh, God, she was epic. She was a Syrian immigrant. She came to the States when she was 6 years old in a very traditional, very conservative Syrian Christian family, and she never made sense in that family. She was also an outsized character. She's just this huge, like, filled every room that she was ever in, vibrant. Nothing could be contained in Raya. And she got into drugs very young. At the age of 12 or 13, she started using drugs because she was the same reason everyone does. You know, some people do it recreationally and some people do it as medication, and she was doing it as medication.
But she was in pain.
She was in pain, as all addicts are. And she spent, from the time she was 12 until she was in her early 30s, as she became ultimately a speedball heroin junkie on the Lower East Side of New York. She was in the punk scene, but at the same time, parallel to that, there was this other version of her who was this brilliant creator and a great musician. She got a music deal from Sony, which she shot right into her arm and never made the record. She was a fabulous indie hairstylist who everyone always wanted to work with, even if she was just one day out of jail. She was she just never stopped being the most exciting person in the room, and finally got clean and was clean for 19 years. So I never knew her during those years. By the time I met her, she was somebody who had lived so many different lives. She'd been homeless, she'd been in prisons, she'd been in mental hospitals, she had been rock bottomed, and what that had afforded her, you know, there's that adage that what does not kill you makes you stronger. My experience with a lot of people is what doesn't kill them makes them a wreck. just a mess. I mean, that's often been the experience in my life. Raya was the embodiment of that she had become. There was a gravity to her. She was unafraid of anything. She'd been through such hell, and she also had such compassion because she had been for so many years the worst person in the world, truly, just an awful human being. Yeah. Not just a drug addict, but a terrible criminal, a user of people, a liar. And she had to go to so many people in her recovery and ask them to forgive her, and many of them did, and she was so humbled by their mercy that she became the embodiment of mercy. And it's not that she didn't have airtight boundaries with people, it's simply that no one in her presence ever felt judgment, and no one ever felt that they would be thrown away no matter how badly they behaved, because she knew what it was like to be a good person trapped in bad behavior. And the love that brought into the room, and the sense of safety, the feeling that everyone had, that we're, I can still remember this feeling. Raya walks in the room and instantly you think, oh, everybody's safe. Not just me, but everyone. Wow. Everyone is safe because, yeah, Raya is here. And so she collected people. Everyone, she was such a rock star. And she is so dearly missed by all of us who loved her, because there was nobody like her.
And Liz, there was a sense then, probably, though, that so she got this diagnosis and you decided to be together. Was there a sense, did you have a sense that what you were signing up for then was to, in a way, be there and mind her in her final journey?
Yes, absolutely. That was what I absolutely signed up for. It's what I volunteered for, and I would do it again in 20 more lifetimes if I had the chance. And it was horrible. And it was much more than I knew I was getting into. I don't think... I was constantly in agreement with my decision, but I don't think you can know what that's going to be until you walk through it. And it was even more harrowing than I had anticipated, because once Raya got to a point in her disease, she was so resistant to taking any painkillers because her sobriety was the most important thing in her life. And, you know, you cannot fight the pain from pancreatic and liver cancer with Tylenol, you know, you mm-hmm. just can't. And so, although she tried to, and she was very tough, there was a point where the only thing that will touch that is opioids. And once You know, and she, that was more devastating to her than the cancer diagnosis, because I just remember her sitting in doctor's offices saying, "You cannot put me on opioids. You do not know what I will become. I know what I will become." And everybody kept reassuring her, "No, it's not like that. You, it used to be that you used it for addiction. This is different." And in fact, she knew herself very well, because as soon as she was put on those opioids, she descended into a terrible darkness of actual addiction again. And I walked through that with her, which was not what either one of us were expecting. And to my amazement, to everyone's amazement, she pulled out of it at the last minute. It was actually remarkable. She was always the comeback kid. She was always, you could never quite get Rhea down, and all of us thought that she was going to die as a junkie, really. But she came back into her sanity, and although she died on painkillers, she died sober and clear and in her own integrity, and I think that was more important to her than anything. But it was hell. It was hell. If you've ever had the pleasure of living with a junkie, I mean, good Lord, I had no idea. I'd read about it. I'd heard all her stories, but being front row to it is a very different experience.
So as a writer, you had a narrative of you there as the strong person carrying her on the final journey and everything.
Yeah.
But and I gather as well that Rhea didn't always kind of conform to your narrative of you caring for her either, did she?
Rhea didn't conform to anybody's narrative. That's why she was Rhea. She couldn't even conform to her own narrative. She was the most ungovernable soul you've ever met in your entire life. She was in full rebellion constantly. She was a terrible patient. She was a nightmare as a patient. And I thought I was the strongest person in the world, that I would be able to handle it. But I will also say this to anybody, even if you're not dealing with somebody who's quite as dramatic as Rhea, if you are the primary caregiver, you yourself need care. And I refused to believe that for such a long time, because I didn't want to even be a self. I just wanted to be in service to Rhea. But ultimately, in the end, I was humbled by the disease, by my own grief. And there were people who stepped in angelically to take care of both of us, which is actually what's required. If the person who you love is dying, then what I pray for you is that there will somebody or some buddies will show up who will take care of you both. Because there came to be a point where I realized that I couldn't. And so her ex-wife and her ex-girlfriend showed up, and Rhea was at that point surrounded. You know, we used to joke she has a hot blonde from every decade of her life taking care of her on her deathbed, which is the only way that Rhea would ever go. Yeah. But even for the three of us, it was a job that exhausted the three of us. But the only way I was able to get through it was with the two of them. So I'm enormously grateful to them forever for that.
Tell me this story. I've seen you tell it before, but the story of the four of you and the, call it, deathbed scene at Christmas.
I know. I'm laughing because, you know what, you get, if you can't laugh at death, get out of show business is kind of where I've gotten to at this point. Like, it's so grim and it's so awful. And then there are these moments of just, so what had happened is that Rhea was, you know, she was very much dying and had been told in November that she, you know, it was really just a matter of days, weeks, you know, and it was so obvious to all of us. If you've seen somebody at the end of their life, it's so clear that they're dying. And she managed to hold out until Christmas, and the four of us spent a beautiful Christmas together, Rhea, her ex-wife, and her ex-girlfriend, her Charlie's Angels, and then I was up at middle of the night, 2 or 3 in the morning, to wake her and give her pain medication that she needed, and I couldn't rouse her, and it was the first time I'd been unable to do that, and there was, you know, her, all the signs, you know, her pulse had slowed, and her skin was cold, and her hands and feet were blue, and there was, the breathing was very ragged, and I just knew that that she had somehow, with her power, she already had lived a year past her initial diagnosis, but that she had held on through Christmas because it mattered to her, and that now she could go. And so I went and woke up the girls and said, "It's happening," and we all climbed into bed with her you know, wrapped our bodies around hers as one, because we had, the three of us really had become one, and we each took turns telling her what she meant to us and what she had done for us, and how noble her life had been, and how remarkable and extraordinary, and how we would never stop being different people because of what she had made us into, and just weeping and holding her and escorting, just this feeling that we were escorting her together out of life into the river of death. And we lit candles and we had sacred music going, and it was so beautiful and so peaceful. And as the sun was rising, she opened up her eyes and said, "What the fuck are you guys doing?" And we were like, "What? Nothing?" You know. And she said, "Why are you burning candles? What's going on? Why is everybody in my bed?" And we instantly, wiping sheets of tears off our faces, said, "Nothing. We're just nothing." You know. And then she lit a cigarette and looked at all of us and said, "You know, what's today's date?" And we said, "December 26th." And she said, "Oh, cool. I want to hit that 60% off sale at Lululemon." And a few hours later, she's shopping the sales for athleisure wear for some life that she still is very much living. And what I learned in this was that the primary thing that I learned in this journey with Rhea is that there is no such thing as a dying person. There are dead people and there are living people. And we keep wanting to treat the dying as though they are dying, but they're actually alive until the moment that they're not. And I wish I had learned that sooner, because I would have behaved very differently with her than I did. But I don't think you can learn that unless somebody like Rhea is brave enough to be your teacher, to volunteer to die first and show you that.
Yeah, someone who's done that journey and been that soldier told me that you can never take away the person's hope, even if everybody else around them knows there is no hope. You can't take that away from them.
That's right. I mean, there's a moment. I have such regard for the soldiers in the armies of death who work, the doctors and the nurses and the caregivers and the hospice people who do this, and ministers, anybody who puts their life on hold to sit with those people. You know, that they say, and what I've also come away with is there's no way to do this right. You know, there's a lot of criticism of Western culture that we do death wrong, and there's a lot of people saying this is how we should do it and this is how we can do it right. And I was on that camp very much at the beginning, like, we're going to have an enlightened death. We're going to have a death that's not afraid of talking about dying. We're going to do this right. not unlike a parent who has a child and thinks, I'm going to do this right,
okay,
until the child arrives and shows you how messy life is. I think death is similar, that you must surrender to forces that are stronger than you. And there is a time, I think, sometimes for people to kind of be called out in their denial, if they're denying that they're dying and it's become impossible for their families, and that has to be discussed. But by God, you know, in the last 2 days of somebody's life, why in the world would you not let them have their hope? It's the last thing they've got.
Mm-hmm. Now, those are the lessons you learned in the journey before her death, and you then did learn a lot about grief as well, didn't you? And you've talked and written very powerfully about grief. Tell us some of the things that you've learned about grief.
Well, again, it's a humbling march. I'm not out of it, and I keep thinking that I am. It's like every single other thing about the human experience. It does not operate on a grid. It does not operate on a timetable other than its own. Grief is an energy field and an energy force that is bigger than us, and that will have its way with us until it's done, not until you think you're done, you know? And so it's almost this God that you have to bow before. And I continue to be brought to my knees by it just when I think that I'm all right. And it comes back and shows me that I'm not. So I think humility is part of it. But another part of it, I think, is the willingness to be in it, the willingness to, when those tsunamis of pain come over you, is very hard to do, because you really do think it will kill you, and you really do get so rigid against it because you don't want to feel that, because it's so awful. But if you have the courage to go limp and to just let it take
accept.
You. Yeah. I mean, that's the hardest thing. Surrender is what we're bad at as humans. Mm-hmm. And grief requires a tremendous amount of conscientious surrender.
Do you just have to let it wash over you?
It'll be done with you when it's done with you. You know, and it'll be done with you. You know, those waves will come, and they'll be done with you maybe in 10 minutes, maybe in 5 hours, maybe in a week. and then you'll get a respite where all of a sudden you're okay. You know, the hurricane has passed and you're okay, and you think, wow, I'm good. And you'll get that for as long as you get that.
Yeah. And then, I saw the singer Nick Cave gave an interview after, remember, his son died tragically.
He's been such a great teacher. Yeah.
Yeah. Crafty was the word he used about grief. I thought it was a great word. Is it crafty?
Yeah, it's crafty. And it's, but it's, there's a very big difference I've learned between grief and depression. I've been through depression in my life, and what I'm experiencing is not that. I think that, and I've learned a lot about this, grief has a vitality to it that depression doesn't. You know, the writer Andrew Solomon said so famously and so accurately that the opposite of depression is not happiness. The opposite of depression is vitality. You can be very unhappy and very sad and very angry and very lost and not be depressed. Depression is the, in a way, it's the absence of feeling all of those things. You know, if you cannot feel the anger, the sadness, the loss, and the despair, then depression is the next stop that you're going to go to. And my friend Martha Beck, who's a great teacher, says, I am willing to feel whatever I need to feel to not be in depression. And so there's, grief is painful, but it's living. And I think all, I've heard it said, all real grief has an element of rejoicing in it. And the rejoicing is that you got to love so much. You got to, not that you had to, but you got to have that experience. As I was in my absolute despair watching Rhea die, her ex-wife said to me, Liz, people would pay all that they had. They would give every single thing that they ever had to experience 1 minute of the love that you felt for Rhea. And this is the cost, you know, this is the cost. You will now pay everything that you have for that love, and it's worth it.
Yeah,
it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it. You are lucky. You are lucky if you get to grieve. So to remember that even as it's happening to you is the grace that separates grief from depression. Because there's no good, there's nothing lucky about being depressed.
Okay, Liz, I promise you we'll get on to the book more in a minute. There is one
other... care. I love talking about that. Okay. I'll go wherever you want
to
go.
I want to ask you about, I suppose, what we'd call the magical thinking as well, because this is something that a lot of people have to a different extent, and I think they'll be interested in hearing about your magical thinking around the grief, the recording of the messages and the dancing and everything. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I've spent my entire life engaged with creativity, and the way that I've been able to do that, the way that I've been able to have as creatively open a life as I have, is that I have a great deal of magical thinking about it. I think, you know, I have a lot of mysticism around it, and I need that. It's what makes creativity work for me. My experience with grief is that grief is the most challenging creative project of my life. Nothing will ask more of you, of your imagination, as you're trying to move through the landscape of grief than that pain. It requires you to come up with something. And so I've come up with lots of things. And they are kind of creative / mystical encounters. One of them is as you say, that I talk to Rhea, and I know that most people will say that they talk to their beloved dead. I think that's a common human experience, but I mean, I do it in a very particular way, which is that I on your iPhone or your smartphone, you surely have a voice recording memo message center where you can just push a button and record a message. Something in the weeks after her death brought me to that because I wanted to talk to her, and so I left her a message. You know, I pushed that button and I talked to her as though I were leaving her a voicemail message. And it was very short and I was very self-conscious doing it, but I felt a lot better afterwards. And so now I do it a great deal. And the messages are no longer like voicemail messages. They're long. I mean, some of these messages are an hour long, where I will just sit and talk to her for an hour. And what I found recently doing it is that if I get very quiet, if I ask her for advice. I mean, I've lost my person who held me safe by giving me advice. I don't have that person anymore. And the world is very loving to me, and there are a lot of beautiful souls in my life and a lot of wisdom, but nobody can do what she did. Nobody can do what she did. And so I'll call her when I'm in my intractable dilemmas, And I'll ask her what to do. And I find that if I get very, very, very still in those recordings, and sometimes those recordings now have 5, 7, 10 minute silences, which is just me listening for a response. And I will get one. And it either comes with me feeling the answer, or it comes with me hearing her voice in my mind telling me the answer, or it comes with a memory that is the answer. You know, some memory between the two of us where I'll see, oh, you're showing me that it's like in that situation, right? I have to do the same thing I did then. And the truth is, Brendan, I don't know, and I don't care whether or not I'm getting those messages from an actual spirit of Rhea. I don't care whether that's coming to me from the beyond or whether I have internalized her so much through the 17 years that we spent together that there's a level at which she lives within me, and that, as a friend of mine said, she's braided into me now, so that perhaps all of that wisdom that she had didn't die with her, that it got downloaded into me. And so when I speak to her, I don't know whether what I'm hearing is in fact my own mind, the Rhea of me, telling me what to do. I don't need to know how it works. I just know that it works. And you know, that I cannot live without Rhea, and so I don't.
Wow. Okay. And then, as we were saying earlier, amazingly, in all this, you write a book that is, did you call it a champagne cocktail?
Yeah, that was my idea.
Fizzes with life and fizzes with fun. But there's a kind of a serious intent to it, I know, from your point of view, which is that you wanted to write a book about female sexuality and about desire. And specifically, I think you say in the foreword, you wanted to write a book about a woman who could be promiscuous without it destroying her.
Yeah, this is a difficult book to find in the Western canon, you know. I mean, we've got Emma Bovary and we've got Anna Karenina and we've got, you know, all sorts of evidence if you were to believe these novels, including the ones I love so much. Portrait of a Lady by Henry James is probably my favorite book. But you know, in every single one of these books, the story is told again and again that a woman dares to step outside of convention. And this is such a narrow, narrow path that women are given even to this day of what is appropriate. And how they must live in order to be regarded as good, and there, you know, for a woman to step out of that and to follow the very messy, very muscular, very dark, and by dark I don't mean sinful, I mean primal, the very dark urge of female sexual desire, you will pay. You may die, but you will certainly pay. And I wanted to, it's not been my experience as a woman who's had a lot of sexual encounters and who, and for whom desire has always, you know, been a huge part of my life. I, like my characters in this book, have faced consequences from my behavior, but I haven't been destroyed by them. I think that what I wanted to say in this is that women can survive their own consequences. Mm-hmm. They actually can. And if they couldn't, there wouldn't be any of us left. You know, like, we can survive more than you think. And this book is peopled by a bunch of girls in the 1940s in the New York City theater world who are doing what young, beautiful girls often do, which is testing the limits of their power, of their sexual power, and choosing freedom over safety again and again and again, often to calamitous effect. Mm-hmm. But those kind of girls are very familiar to my heart, and they existed in New York City in 1940 just as much as they exist now, just as much as they existed 100 years ago. There's always been that girl, and there will always be that girl. And I wanted to tell her story, but to tell it, the book is written from the point of view of a woman in her 90s looking back on her reckless youth. So I wanted to tell it from the perspective of time. That's what I've done.
And I read somewhere that you described the characters in the book as not woke, but they are awakening. So obviously the whole Me Too movement was blowing up, presumably while you were writing this book. So did that make things difficult, or did it change anything with the book?
Well, I was aware of it, and I'm more than aware of it. I'm delighted by it. It's that kickback of female rage at violence and oppression is so overdue and so needed, and I delight in watching it, and I delight as a feminist in the fact that for the first time in my life, I'm 50 this year, but this is the first time in my life that I've ever seen the patriarchy on the run, that the patriarchy is on the defensive, and where feminism has always been on the defensive. It's it's now turned. There's a power surge that's turning, and it's fantastic, and it's important. And a great deal of that conversation is about consent, and about whether or not women are giving their consent. I think that's vital. I also, this is not a but, this is an and.
Yeah.
And I also want to say that the final word in female sexuality is not necessarily consent. There are other aspects of female sexuality as well that have to do with a woman acting on her own urges, a woman as predator, a woman as a huntress, a woman pointing to something and saying, I want that and I'm going to do anything to get that.
Have we forgotten that a little bit in all this conversation? The most common kind of archetype of a woman now can tend to be in a victim-style role in all this conversation?
Not only have we forgotten it, I'm not sure that we in our culture have ever really known about it.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
fair enough.
You know, like it's been so suppressed, and it's often so suppressed by women ourselves because we have a lot of shame around that, you know. Mm-hmm. Female sexual desire is very threatening, not just to culture, but to women. You know, like, trust me, as a woman who has a lot of it, I don't know what to do with it. Yeah. You know, like nobody knows what to do with it. So what I want to leave space for, and it's only a question of my request is only that we leave space for the idea that women also go on the attack sexually. And I don't mean to bring somebody down. I don't mean in that sort of horrible way of a woman trying to destroy someone's reputation. That's not what I mean by the attack. I mean a woman who wants something and will go get it. That is also a story of female sexual desire. That's also been a story of my life. It's been a story of a lot of women who I know. And that's what this book is about. And it doesn't mean that it's clean. And I think we keep trying as a culture. We try it with religion. We try it with politics. We try it with feminism. We keep trying to clean sex so that it will be safe. And it's never been my experience that it is safe. It is something that rules us in ways that are incredibly complicated. So the sanitizing of sex, we can keep trying, and that does not mean that rape is okay. That does not mean that sexual discrimination in the workforce is okay. A lot of this it needs to be addressed, but I also think we have to be careful to just recognize that we are wrestling with dragons here, and that human history has shown that we're not very good at getting this thing under control.
I love wrestling with dragons.
Now, yes.
Speaking of kind of wrestling with dragons in a way, obviously you're best known for your memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. Still a huge phenomenon, really, I would say. Why did it resonate so much with people, do you think?
I think, I used to say I don't know, but I think there's something disingenuous about that, and I like it better these days when women don't answer questions by saying I don't know. So let me tell you what I think.
Yeah.
I think that book became a permission slip for millions of women to
leave their husbands.
Yeah, well, or their jobs, or mm-hmm. their... the life that they had chosen that simply wasn't working out for them. This doesn't mean that everyone has to do this, you know?
Yeah.
I'm constantly saying this to people. Nobody's required to leave their marriage and go travel around the world, or no one is required to have a spiritual journey. No one is required to ask these questions of their life. However, if you are sick and suffering in your life and dying every single day, because what you thought was supposed to make you happy turns out does not. You are mm-hmm. allowed to ask these questions. Mm-hmm. You are invited. And if I've done nothing else than hand out permission slips for many people, but especially for women, to allow themselves to ask, why is this not working for me? And what do I get to do as opposed to what I have to do? And one thing that I quite love, I was talking the other night, I met someone at a publishing party, and she said, I had my own Eat, Pray, Love journey a few years ago. And I hear that from people all the time, and I love it because I love that what that title has become is a shorthand that women can say where they don't have to get into the whole thing. They uh-huh. don't have to say, uh-huh. like, bad breakup, you know, big mistakes, miscarriage, divorce, got fired from my job, illness. You know, they don't have to go into what had happened that was so awful. We just know when they say, I went on an Eat, Pray, Love journey, something wasn't working. Yeah. They changed it. They went away. They had an adventure and they came back better. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, if all I've done is like make there be a term for that, then I'm very happy that that's my contribution.
I want to talk as well about a few other kind of more random scattergun things. You talk about a lot of stuff and in podcasts, social media and everything else, and you have an enormous following on social media, obviously. And a few things that I thought interesting outside of your fiction. You've talked recently about mothers on social media, and given that this is Ireland, we probably should talk about mothers at some stage. Tell me about this idea you have that we have to show the mothers some mercy.
Yeah, so it was Mother's Day and I was trying to figure out what to say, and I was scrolling through social media and I was seeing all the standard, really on Mother's Day in the States, I don't know how it is there, but, you know, there's two things you see. You know, one is, you know, thanks, Mom, I love you, you're the best. The other one is, this is the worst day of the year for me because of my horrible mother. Mm-hmm. And I feel so much for those people. Like all of us, I've struggled with my mother as well. And I had recently been at an event where a question was asked, how many of you are afraid of turning into your mothers? It was a room full of women, probably 500 women. How many of you are afraid of turning into your mothers? Almost every single one of those women raised her hand. And seeing that broke my heart for their mothers, because I thought, are they all that terrible? You know, like I'm in a room, I'm not in a room with women who are in prison, you know, or who are prostituting themselves in the street. I'm in a room with like really successful looking women who are living rich lives and who have families and children and jobs and, you know, a lot of emotional pain like we all do. But like, is it possible that every single one of these 500 women had a terrible failure as a mother, or...
But it's clearly possible they're all blaming their mother, yes.
Well, that's for sure. And or is it possible that we have, as a culture, have created an expectation of what a mother is that is absolutely impossible to be met, so that you cannot succeed, so that you cannot succeed as a mother, because what you have to be in order to be considered a good mother is not human. You know, and so my heart broke that day, and I remember just thinking, oh, could we all just have a little bit of mercy on these female humans who raised us, who had their own pain, their own limitations, their own addictions, their own drama, their own desires, their own just doubts and depression, their own mental illness, their own whatever it was that we expected as their children that they should put aside, you know, in order to be perfect for us. And that they could not put aside, in the same way that we can't put aside our own demons, you know. And mercy is a word that is just infiltrating my consciousness at such a deep level these days, because I feel like it's our only hope. We're living in such a merciless world.
And, is that it? Is that what it is, you think?
I think like that mercilessness is growing, and I don't
in the broader culture.
Yeah, and by mercy, and again, mercy doesn't mean that what happened to you at their hands is okay. It doesn't mean that people get a free pass. It doesn't mean that if punishment needs to happen, that it doesn't happen. It doesn't mean that you can't set boundaries. You can show mercy on somebody and never speak to them again. But in your heart, you can feel mercy for our shared... All I see is our shared, intractable human dilemmas that we all live in, the places of ourselves that we cannot fix. And the only balm for that is mercy. And the more merciless we are, of course, out there in the world toward each other, the less mercy we have for ourselves. And the rise of depression and anxiety and suicide, and there's a self-hatred that's growing as well, because we don't have models in our culture of what it would look like to actually live in a state of mercy toward ourselves and everyone.
Liz, I don't know about you, but I am emotionally exhausted after that. It was extraordinary talking to you. Thank you so much, Liz.
I'm emotionally exhausted all the time.
I have a lot to think about there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome,
Liz,
sweetheart.
City of Girls is in bookshops now, and you're coming to Ireland later in the month.
Yes, I am.
So you'll be in conversation with Anna Carey at an event produced by the International Literary Festival Dublin on Tuesday the 25th of June. And for more information, check out the website ilfdublin.com. Liz Gilbert, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, honey. Bye.
Bye.
podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.